Jays.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The $400 per child tax refund promised in President Bush's newly signed tax cut measure will be mailed out beginning in July. But the check will not be in the mail for working families with combined income totals between $10,500 and $26,000. Because of last-minute attempts to keep the total tax credit package under $350 billion, those families were cut out of the tax cut. And the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities estimates that one out of every six children under 17 in the country falls into that category. Well, joining us to discuss the change is David Firestone of the New York Times. He's been covering the budget story in Washington. And David, remind us how this child tax credit works. Families of a certain income were already getting a $600 tax credit, right?
That's right. The tax credit was raised to $600 2 years ago, and the current tax bill, it was raised again to $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
That $400 difference is going to be mailed out in the form of a check this summer to most taxpayers, except at the highest and lowest end of the spectrum.
Well, families with incomes below $10,000 were never eligible for a refund. They don't pay federal taxes. But this group, with the incomes we mentioned from $10,000 to roughly $26,000, did they receive it before?
They were able to get the $600 credit or a portion of it, depending on how much they made. It was a sliding scale based on a percentage of their income over $10,500.
Yeah. Well, tell us about this 11th-hour wrangling that led to their omission from this new increase.
The Senate, led by Senator Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, had voted to allow this $400 to be refunded to this group of families, and it passed the full Senate. Many senators felt that it was unfair to not extend it to families who were working and paying taxes. It didn't cost an enormous amount in comparison to the size of the bill. It was about $3.5 billion out of a $350 billion bill.
But it was going to put them over the top. And just to interrupt you for a second, as you write, Senator George Voinovich of Ohio was one of those who said it's got to stay at 350. And his office said, you know, his opinion was they can just take it out of the tax relief on stocks to make up the difference. But they didn't.
They could have taken it from any of the various tax cuts that are part of the bill. But the idea behind the bill, according to the Republicans, was to create jobs, and they believe that this is going to happen through these dividend tax cuts, capital gains cuts, business expenses that are part of the bill. And the other tax credit, child tax credit, is not a direct creator of jobs in that same way as they saw it.
Right, but as you write, one Democratic senator said, you know, her constituents in this price range were the ones buying jeans and detergent. They could have jumped the economy. But the question is, do they vote? And not to be too cynical, but was there a sense that, you know, this group doesn't matter? And we only have a few seconds.
I don't think it was quite that naked in terms of the political calculation. I think it was more a philosophical question of whether money at the top of the income spectrum will create more jobs to people who have small businesses, or whether you create it by giving it to people who spend. That's one of the basic differences now between the two parties.
Mm. And in just a few seconds, what do you think these people who now find themselves not receiving that check, how do you think they'll respond?
I think they're going to be surprised because they were used to getting that credit. They've seen these stories about how the checks are being mailed out. I suspect there will be a few calls placed to Washington once they realize that they won't be getting it.
Yeah. Well, David, thank you.
My pleasure.
David Firestone, Washington reporter for The New York Times.
Well, still on the subject of the tax cuts, by now a lot of us know that many economists believe in the wake of the cuts, the federal budget will go deeper and deeper into deficit. It turns out just how deep was calculated in a report released late last year by former, since fired, Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. He determined there will be a chronic future federal deficit totaling at least $44 trillion. Now, this assessment was not included in the president's annual budget report for fiscal 2004, which was presented in February. Some say because it would have argued against tax cuts. To learn more about the O'Neill report, we're joined now by someone who's read it. Lawrence Kotlikoff is chairman of the Department of Economics at Boston University. He joins me on the line from his home office in Lexington, Massachusetts. Hello.
Hi.
Professor, you wrote in a recent editorial that you believe the Bush administration suppressed the research in order to ease passage of the tax cut plan. Now, is suppressed the right word here? That suggests something underhanded.
Yeah, I think it's the right word. The Treasury spent most of the fall working very hard, a group within the Treasury, on this study, and it was pulled right at the last minute after O'Neill was fired. Within a week or so of his being fired, they decided to throw it out of the budget. Now, what it shows is that if you had to pay off all the future bills the government has coming with all the receipts the government has coming, that the difference would be, the shortfall would be $44 trillion.
Over what period of time?
Well, these numbers are calculated as the value in the present. So it's saying, how much money do we need today? And it turns out to be $44 trillion in order to cover all the future bills without raising taxes. And, of course, we don't have that extra $44 trillion. And one way we could come up with it would be to raise taxes by 69% immediately and permanently. Another option would be to increase payroll taxes immediately and permanently by 95%. Another option would be to cut Social Security and Medicare benefits immediately and permanently by about 45%.
None of that likely to happen.
None of that's likely to happen. But if we wait, all these numbers I just gave you get worse. So what this study showed, and it's actually using pretty optimistic assumptions about the future, is that our country is effectively bankrupt. And the president and his policies has just made that about 20% worse.
Now, historically, how unusual is this situation?
Lots of countries have gotten in above their heads in fiscal obligations. If you look at Argentina today, they really bankrupt themselves, and they're paying a huge price. Russia had to default on its debt.
Are we getting in the same league as Argentina and Russia?
We're heading down that path. We're not there yet, and there are still things that we can do. But we're not paying any attention to the fact that 77 million baby boomers are going to be starting to collect their Social Security benefits in 5 years, and in 8 years they're going to get their Medicare benefits, begin to get those benefits. In 30 years, we're going to have twice the number of old people and only about 18% more workers to pay for their benefits. So you can see that we got a huge problem.
Now, Professor, there's also economic theory out there that the deficits are not as bad as they look. Under the Reagan deficits, they encompassed 6% of the gross domestic product. But these deficits will encompass much less of the deficit, and some argue so they're not that bad.
Well, those people argue that really are being deluded by these deficit numbers. They're not really describing our true fiscal obligations. Every year that we let Medicare benefits grow, we're increasing our future obligations to pay Medicare beneficiaries, and so we're increasing our implicit debt. So the debt you're talking about, or the deficits, are just reflective of our explicit or official debt, but there's this enormous implicit debt, which is growing at leaps and bounds, and it is not being included in the calculation. And that's where this $44 trillion problem is coming from. It's really from all the things that are off the books that aren't being recorded, but these are real obligations. We're going to have to pay 77 million baby boomers their benefits when they hit retirement.
Paul O'Neill was fired by the administration in December. How much of that, if anything, had to do with this report?
I think O'Neill had a big problem, which is he liked to tell the truth. And that's something that this administration and the previous administration and the one before that and the one before that, they don't like to have people speak the truth. We have had a conspiracy by all the different administrations since Eisenhower's, really, to hide our long-term fiscal problems, and each administration has compounded them. So this is just Washington, their standard modus operandi.
Lawrence Kotlikoff, thank you very much for joining us on Here and Now.
My pleasure.
Lawrence Kotlikoff is chairman of the Department of Economics at Boston University.
A U.S. soldier was killed in Iraq today when a rocket-propelled grenade hit the convoy he was traveling in. The death comes in a week that has seen 8 other U.S. soldiers killed and nearly 24 wounded. And there are reports today that American officials have revised plans for a rapid reduction of troop numbers in Iraq. The latest tactics call for an extended stay for about 160,000 U.S. and British troops who will be used to assert control over the country. But can Iraq be controlled? And is this week's violence a symptom of chaos or the beginning of coordinated resistance to American occupation? Eileen Prusher is a staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor. She's been to the town of Fallujah, the scene of some of this week's violence, and she joins us now from Baghdad. Eileen, remind us, how did the violence play out in Fallujah this week?
Well, what happened earlier this week was that soldiers manning a position in Fallujah, which is a city about 45 minutes northwest of Baghdad, were attacked. They were sort of ambushed from two different cars with rocket-propelled grenades and semi-automatic weapons fire. Two soldiers there were killed. Now, Fallujah is a place that's sort of well-known for being loyal to the Ba'ath Party and to Saddam Hussein. But what I found there on my visit that was surprising was that it's not that people there are necessarily so loyal to Saddam and think that they're going to get him to come back, but they do seem extremely frustrated with the idea of American troops patrolling their streets, and they seem to be making pretty strong demands at this point for saying that the U.S. troops have to leave, and if they don't, that they can expect more attacks of this kind.
Did you get the sense, Eileen, that this was sort of an organic grassroots protest, or was it organized?
Very difficult to say. When I asked that question, people said it was a popular resistance. Some people even started using the term jihad, and they said it was spreading because there were attacks, of course, in a few different places in Iraq this week. And when I talked to U.S. military sources, they say they're also not really clear at this point whether or not this is something well-organized or if it's just pockets of violence and troublemaking, but that could eventually grow into something larger and perhaps could be organized at some point.
And the U.S. military has reacted. We mentioned that some troops that were scheduled to leave are now staying. What other questions are being raised by the violence this week?
Well, there are many. I mean, I think one of them, of course, that you raised is whether or not the troops are going to get caught up in dealing with these sorts of ambushes and security problems so that they won't be able to focus on the sort of rebuilding efforts and post-war reconstruction that the Bush administration was hoping they might be able to concentrate on at this point, which, of course, is something like 7 weeks since the fall of Baghdad.
Which, of course, sounds like it could be the setup for a vicious cycle.
Yes, that's definitely true, and I think it's a really crucial point because the thing to remember is that there probably is a majority of Iraqis who do feel like there is, or at least there was, some reason for optimism with the fall of the regime. But at the same time, a lot of average Iraqis' lives have not improved in the last month and a half, and some people still living without electricity and clean water. So if those humanitarian efforts are not able to proceed peacefully, I think more Iraqis are going to start saying, well, are these American troops our liberators or our occupiers?
Eileen, thank you.
You're welcome.
Eileen Prusher, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Baghdad. To read more of Eileen's reporting, go to our website, here-now.org.
Just ahead is a small yet influential group of people inside the Pentagon preparing to make the case for regime change in Iran.
And later, why students can't write.
And a guitar lesson from Pat Metheny.
There's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Spine Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, a collaboration with Massachusetts General Hospital, 866-NWH-DOCS, on the web at nwh.org. And by the Huntington Theater Company, presenting Springtime for Henry, a classic comedy playing now through June 15th, 617-266-0800. This is WBUR.
NPR's Sylvia Poggioli.
Kosovo Albanians, the overwhelming majority of the population, are impatiently demanding independence. The dwindling number of Serbs, strongly supported by Belgrade, insist Kosovo must remain part of Serbia.
Meet Sylvia Poggioli and ask her your questions about the Balkans and other major stories she's covered this Sunday at a brunch hosted by Tom Ashbrook. For tickets to benefit WBUR, call 800-909-9287.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In the Pentagon, there's a small cluster of policy advisors and analysts who call themselves, jokingly, the cabal. including names like Abe Shulsky, Douglas Feith, and Louis Libby. Their job is to second-guess intelligence readings by the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA. They have Donald Rumsfeld's ear, and when they built the case for war in Iraq, they made a lot of enemies in the intelligence bureaucracy. Intelligence experts that Here and Now spoke with say this group is presently hard at work building a case for regime change in Iran. We're joined now by two of the cabal's critics. Judith Yaffe, a former CIA senior analyst, now a research fellow at the National Defense University, joins us from Washington.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks. And Vincent Canestraro is a former chief of counterterrorism at the CIA and now a private consultant. He joins us from McLean, Virginia. Hello, Vincent.
I'm fine. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, both of you. Judith Yaffe, just to start with you, before we get to the question of the cabal, let's talk about intelligence. The quality of intelligence, of course, can determine how a decision maker acts, like a president.
Yes.
First off, how much raw data comes in every day to U.S. intelligence agencies?
More than you could possibly imagine. But the question is how much of it is super sensitive and secret, and how much can be culled from the public domain. And I think you might be surprised to hear that. I think the majority of good intelligence really does come from the public domain, from the open source material. A good intelligence officer is an all-source scholar, researcher, if you will, and looks at all sources of information. So it's everything from the press and public statements to what's supposed to be the very latest and special, super secret, here's what they're really thinking, and I'll have to kill you if I tell you this kind of information.
Now, Vincent Canestraro, who interprets the data, and is there an interpretation that usually turns out to be the one that most agree on?
Well, I think, the experience level is very telling here. It's someone who's used to working in that particular area has developed a track record. The track record is expressed in written products, whether they're intelligence judgments, assessments, or memoranda. And over a period of time, you build up this record, which can be checked. So, you can make value judgments among the analysts and among the sources from which the intelligence products derive.
Judith Yaffe, what is the cabal?
The cabal, I think you're referring to, are the political appointees called the neocons, who are in several places in government, but in the Pentagon, political appointees who are there to further the policy of the administration. That policy, for example, war with Iraq, regime change is important for Iraq. And now they are turning their their gun sights towards other offenders of American interests and priorities.
So Vincent Canestraro, this so-called cabal has the potential to tilt the president's policy toward whether, for example, to bring some sort of military or covert action to Iran?
Yeah, I think as Judy has suggested very strongly, what we're talking about is intelligence being politicized. These are people, particularly in the Office of Special Plans, who are taking the intelligence community's products and saying, no, this doesn't fit the policy that we would like, and then going out and deliberately looking for things that do fit their a priori assumptions. And that's the real danger.
Do you think there's more?
If I could just interject one thing. The president, the political establishment that we have here, has to want to listen to the intelligence offered. The best intelligence in the world will do you no good if you say, I don't like the message, so I'm going to shoot the messenger.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important point. It's the messenger is not being listened to because it's not delivering the message that the ideologues want to hear, and that's the problem.
On the other hand, over the years, the CIA, for example, an intelligence gathering enterprise, has gotten a lot of things wrong, like the fall of the Soviet Union, and we know what the list is.
Well, they get things wrong. It's not, no one's going to be 100% accurate, particularly in the analytical field. But the problem is that a lot of the intelligence that finds its way into policy pronouncements is produced by a Pentagon that's comprised of people who don't have an experience level and who don't have an operational experience level. And but let me give you an example. They were dealing with the INC, the Iraqi National Congress, Ahmad Chalabi's organization, and that was a source of intelligence. Well, we know that a lot of material that came from Chalabi was meant to cater to a point of view. A lot of it was distorted. A lot of it was a fabrication.
Is data interpretation now more politicized than ever before or not?
Judy, why don't you answer that?
No, you answered.
Yes, I would say yes. I've lived through the era of Bill Casey and saw his points of view trying to be imposed. But he didn't do it successfully because the analysts showed a degree of independence. There's a real question whether today the analysts have that ability to resist those kinds of political pressures and whether the director of the intelligence community, the DCI himself, is resisting these pressures in any meaningful way.
How concerned should we be at this point that interpretation could be spun now by people inside the Pentagon, for example, that could make the case for military action in Iran?
Well, I think by their actions in Iraq, that develops a degree of skepticism about any future allegations and charges that the Iranians, for example, are close to producing a nuclear device on their own. Whether they are or not, I don't know. But at least the pronouncements that they are suspect, given the track record in Iraq.
Judith Yaffe?
Yes. There is a great danger that, you cry wolf so many times, no one will listen to the warnings anymore.
I want to thank both of you. Vincent Canestraro, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
And Judith Yaffe, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Vincent Canestraro is former chief of counterterrorism operations, and Judith Yaffe is a former senior intelligence analyst, both at the CIA. We want to mention we made repeated requests to speak to several members of the so-called cabal. Most refused, though one official is considering our request. If he agrees, we'll have him on our show at a future date.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Epson, makers of the Stylus CX5200, the only all-in-one with DuraBright inks for images that resist damage from water, light, and smudges, available at local retailers. By Schneider Leasing Company, providing short-term computer rental services for conferences, conventions, and special events, 617-261-6060. And by Lala Roque on Beacon Hill, now accepting reservations for graduation celebrations at 617-720-5511 or online at lalaroqh.com. Later this hour in Here and Now, a conversation with jazz guitarist Pat Metheny. 68 degrees right now under partly sunny skies in Boston. This is WBUR.
What makes a Citizens of the World Tour special?
We had wonderful meals in exotic places.
It was exciting and it was fun, and we got unbelievable treatment and unbelievable accommodations and food and everything. It was really a great time.
Join Sylvia Pajoli on our next Citizens of the World Tour to Tuscany and Umbria this summer. You'll enjoy stays in the Palazzo Terranova, a beautifully restored villa overlooking the Umbrian countryside, and Siena's luxurious 14th-century Locanda dell'Amorosa, surrounded by its own farmlands, vineyards, and gardens. For more information, call 800-909-9287.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a teacher tells us why so many students can't write. And boy, they can't write.
Virtually every sentence is flawed. Their thoughts are tortured. And I liken reading some of their papers to riding down a road with nothing but speed bumps on it.
And who will pay for summer reading camps in Florida for third graders who failed a statewide exam?
As far as where they're getting the money, they're looking behind couch cushions for a little spare change.
These stories and guitarist Pat Metheny coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols.
Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers will meet in a few hours for a second round of talks on the roadmap to peace ahead of President Bush's visit to the region. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice says, conditions permitting, the president will meet with the leaders next week.
We're watching the circumstances. We're watching to see if the parties are moving forward. It is, after all, the case that the parties have to be dedicated and devoted in moving forward. But we believe that we're at a place where this meeting is likely to be very helpful.
Palestinian officials are calling for a clear statement from Israel that recognizes their right to a state. Meantime, Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas is making some headway in discussions with two Islamic militant groups on a proposed ceasefire. Hamas says it could agree to halt suicide attacks on Israel as soon as next week, while members of the group Islamic Jihad says they'll stop attacks if Israel halts military operations against Palestinians. An American soldier in Iraq has been killed after his convoy came under attack on a main supply route about 25 miles north of Baghdad. The military says a rocket-propelled grenade was the cause of the incident. The death brings to the number of U.S. soldiers who have died in Iraq this week to 9. And one German peacekeeper is dead and another wounded after their vehicle hit a landmine near Kabul today. The death brings to 15 the number of peacekeepers who have died on duty in Afghanistan. Sniper suspect John Muhammad could face the death penalty if convicted of killing a man in Manassas, Virginia. Defense attorneys plan to argue Muhammad didn't pull the trigger. Younger suspect Lee Malvo is said to have already admitted to that. Prosecutors say it doesn't matter who fired the shot. They say they've got evidence to prove Muhammad was the instigator. And the first man to climb Mount Everest is being honored by the government of Nepal. Nepalese officials have awarded honorary citizenship to New Zealand native Sir Edmund Hillary. Hillary reached the summit of Everest with his Sherpa partner Tenzing Norgay 50 years ago. Some 1,300 people have reached the top of Mount Everest since then. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 37 points at 8030. The Nasdaq is up 27 at 1589. And the S&P is up 7 at 960. It's 33 minutes past the hour. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Harvard Bookstore and Harvard.com, chosen Boston Magazine's Best of Boston 2002 for their selection of new, used, and remaindered books, Harvard Square's landmark literary and scholarly bookstore. By the restaurant Clio at the Elliott Hotel, named one of America's 50 best hotel restaurants by Food and Wine Magazine 2003, reservations at ElliottHotel.com, and by TechFusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialist. TechFusion helps prevent data disasters from happening now and in the future. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. In the forecast today, a mixture of clouds and sun, a chance of an afternoon shower with highs around 70. Partly cloudy tonight, 55 degrees. And tomorrow, a sunny start with a chance of afternoon showers, highs in the 70s. 68 degrees right now in Boston. In sports, the Red Sox are off tonight. This is WBUR.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
If you remember struggling to write term papers in high school, you may be giving away a little more about your age than you'd like to. You know, digging away at a pile of books you'd hauled home from the library to explain the Renaissance or World War II or the history of the Philippines, and then having to footnote the whole thing and draw up an index. It was hard labor, and there was a lot of it. But note that word was. Because term papers and writing itself as a craft demanded of high school students are disappearing from more and more schools. A situation we'd like to discuss now with Jack Farrell, who's a high school teacher in Newberry Park, California. Hi, Jack.
Hello there.
Jack, what's the state of the venerable term paper?
Well, it's still in place in many schools, but it is passing away. And I'm really concerned that it's even passing away at the community college level, but I'm not sure that it's out there very much in academia at all anymore.
How come?
Part of the problem is that we are pretty much obsessed with standardized testing. We've decided to rank ourselves and rate ourselves based on our performance there. And I just put students in my school through 4 days of testing about 2 weeks ago. And there wasn't one single test that wasn't a bubble test. So that's 4 straight days of filling in bubbles. And if that's how the school is going to be judged, and that's how schools are, that's how students are going to qualify for college, then there seems to be a pressure to produce those tests almost exclusively in all content areas.
Kids don't write as well as they used to?
No, they think as well as they used to. And as far as oral conversation is concerned, education has pretty much become an oral experience. But when they have to produce a piece of academic writing, they're in real trouble. And I'm talking about even some of the brighter students. When they have to produce a more formal piece of writing, they freeze. And virtually every sentence is flawed. Their thoughts are tortured. And I liken reading some of their papers to riding down a road with nothing but speed bumps on it.
As far as writing is concerned, the root of good writing is reading. Are students not reading the way they used to as well?
Students have found an easy path through it, and the path does not involve a lot of reading. And that's what I noticed in the classes I observed, both in veteran teachers' classrooms and in beginning teachers, was that the students were not reading their content area text. They weren't reading their biology book. They weren't reading their history book. They weren't reading their chemistry book. They were simply looking at the questions at the end of the chapter. They know the architecture of a nonfiction text, and so they know how to go back and find the bold-faced headings. They know how to find the terms that are in boldface, and they write down the answers word for word from the text. It satisfies the teacher because they've done the homework, and they actually do pretty well on the test. My concern is that although students are learning, they are going to hit a dead end in education, because there's a point at which if you can't master content and text independently, you're dead. We're finding that students by about the sophomore year in college are washing out at an alarming rate. And I think the books are part of the problem. If you take a look at any modern textbook, it's filled with color, it's filled with graphical content, it's filled with icons, it's filled with discontinuous text boxes, splashes of color over the text.
MTV textbooks.
Right. I liken it to web pages.
What to do about it?
Well, what I've been trying to do in my classroom is a kind of a read-first strategy, which is that we've been doing too many motivational sets, or what are called anticipatory sets, where we set the purpose for the reading. And we do a lot of preloading of important terms, a preloading of difficult vocabulary for the students so that they can have a successful first read of the text. I think there's nothing wrong with a student being challenged and somewhat lost on a first reading of a text. And we should say, you know, you're in there struggling. Now I'm going to come in with my scaffolds to support you.
Jack Farrell, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Jack Farrell is a high school teacher at Newberry Park High School in Newberry Park, California. His website is www.readfirst.net.
Well, from high school to grade school, 43,000 of Florida's third graders are being encouraged to attend summer camp, but not the one they might want. The students failed the FCAT, or Florida's Comprehensive Assessment Test, and because of tougher standards enforced this year, they will not be allowed to advance to the fourth grade in the fall unless they improve their reading. Well, joining us on the line from St. Petersburg, Florida, is Steve Hegarty. He's education writer for the St. Petersburg Times. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. Wow, these numbers, that's almost a quarter of Florida's third graders who are in trouble here. Were those numbers unexpected?
You know, a lot of people were surprised and appalled by those numbers, but they probably should not have been, because we tested our third graders last year and the numbers look just about the same.
Well, tell us about these summer camps that the governor's office have suggested.
The most complicated thing about it is that we're all doing it on the fly. We don't do traditional summer school in Florida the way we used to. We work with kids all school year long. But the governor in, I guess it was mid-April, decided, oh, geez, we got all these kids that are going to have to be retained. Why don't we work with them during summer school? So the districts have been scrambling to put something together, and it's got to be fairly high quality or you're not going to get anything out of it.
Right. The recommendation is for 6 to 8 weeks of intensive reading instruction, 4 days a week for 5.5 hours a day. That's going to take a lot of personnel. What about, you know, the fact that it's so late in the season? People have made their schedules. Are teachers
right.
available? Are schools available? Is money available?
Well, first of all, what you just described is not what's going to happen. That's what the governor would like to see happen. But I know that in my school district, Pinellas County, they're doing 4 weeks, and the kids might get an hour or two a day, and it's a four-day week. So that's right there. That's quite a bit less than what the governor had hoped. Some other districts are doing about 2 weeks. As far as where they're getting the money, you know, they're looking behind couch cushions for a little spare change. I mean, they're coming to the end of their budget year, and some people are piecing it together with some federal money. There is some money for next year, but that's next year.
And, Steve, is there a sense that if these kids couldn't learn what they needed to know during the full school year, How are they going to do it in 2, 3, 4 weeks?
Yeah, that's the question everybody's asking. After talking with a lot of teachers, here's what I've decided is probably true. There are some kids, especially that age, that they're just waiting for the light bulb to go off. When they took the FCAT, the state test, that was back in March. We've had a couple of months for them to learn a few things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for some of these kids, it will happen over the summer. They'll just be ready. They'll be working with some teachers, and it'll be great. But, you know, out of 43,000 statewide, I'm not even going to venture a guess as to how many are going to pass. So far, we've had like something short of 10% that passed this very tough test the second go-round, because they already failed it. So we're dealing with a population that, you know, they're having some struggles here with their reading.
And they, as you mentioned, they will be retested, but has there been any discussion about the psychological impact this has on third graders? You know, being left back is a big deal.
Well, teachers refer to the research that says, it's damaging to a kid to retain them. I think they say two retentions, as research says, it's sort of the kiss of death as far as a kid finishing high school and being successful.
But on the other hand, not knowing how to read is damaging too.
Yeah, the governor and the education secretary have a nice little slogan that they use, and even though it is a slogan, I think it's pretty good. And they say that in third grade you're learning to read, but in fourth grade you're reading to learn. So if you don't know how to read, there's a lot of stuff you're just not going to learn. I mean, you need to read to do your math problems, that sort of thing. So, yeah, you do fall behind.
Well, Steve, we'll keep an eye on how this experiment works out. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks.
Steve Hegarty, reporter for the St. Petersburg Times in Florida.
Still to come, Berklee College of Music students died and went to guitar heaven when Pat Metheny came to give a master class. We'll sit in.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
The bulk of our mail this week came in response to our editorial roundtable discussion of President Bush's tax cut plan. Colin Murphy writes, "What an amazing comment one of your guests made about Warren Buffett's negative view of the tax cut. Nonsensical rantings, your guest called them, and it went unchallenged. Buffett is one of the most successful businessmen in the world, and his comments about the tax cut's impact are not just opinion. They're based on economic insight."
Well, Robin Stelly of Philadelphia also had a bone to pick regarding the roundtable, and she joins us now on the line. Robin, what was it about that discussion that bugged you?
I found the attitudes of the two journalists to be depressing. I thought they seemed angry at us for not being informed about the tax cuts, bored at having to inform us, and just apathetic about their whole role in the process.
In other words, it felt like they had stepped out of their role as objective journalists and were kind of criticizing people for not having somehow dug in deeper as to what these tax cuts really are.
Right, when they are our primary source of information. I use three things to get information. I use NPR programs like yours. I use yours every day. I use the internet, some web blogs on the internet, which are very helpful and moderate, and I use the New York Times.
Robin, do you feel like in the case of this tax cut, it's been explained well enough to people?
I don't think so at all. And even if it had, I think today's news that at the last minute they dropped a provision that would ensure child credit to lower-income people got sort of snuck in at the last minute. And so even if we had been informed, that wouldn't have helped us in this regard. But I don't think overall that we've been informed enough now.
It's certainly something we've been conscious of here at Here and Now. I myself have found myself at sea repeatedly with this tax cut and trying to sort out all the different levels of it. So we'll try to do better next time.
Okay. I won't stop listening.
Thanks, Robin Stelly.
Bye-bye.
Well, our interview with the brothers of the first unknown soldier identified from the Korean War brought us this email from Coleman Nee of Cohasset, Mass. "I don't cry easy, but I had a tear in my eye after that piece. It should serve as a reminder to all of us that the scars of war linger with vets long after the yellow ribbons have faded. If Americans really want to support vets, we should work to provide the money needed to treat them and care for them long after the shooting has stopped."
Well, second that, we received quite a bit of mail following Robin's Memorial Day essay about her dad's funeral. Jeff Field writes, "My dad, too, was a veteran, and he is no longer with us. Like your dad, mine gave me things that I will carry with me always and will pass along to my own son.
And finally, Jared Nathanson correctly noted a mistake on our webpage that described the music featured in the new documentary Only the Strong Survive as Motown, when in fact the songs featured are soul classics from the Memphis-based Stax Records. Thank you, Jared. And here's some more of Stax artist Carla Thomas performing Gee Whiz.
Gee Whiz.
And as always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember, include your name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Landry and Arcari, Oriental Rugs and Carpeting, hosting Designer Night, a presentation by three interior designers on coordinating pattern rugs and furnishings tonight at 6:30 p.m. in Boston. By Flora Restaurant on Mass Ave in Arlington, featuring a new private dining room for business or pleasure, seasonal menus created by Chef Bob Sargent, on the web at florarestaurant.com. And Boston Botanicals, offering comprehensive interior plant service and design to businesses in Greater Boston and proprietors of a unique flower shop in downtown Boston. Come explore the art and culture of Tuscany and Umbria with Silvia Poggioli on our next Citizens of the World tour this summer. Proceeds help pay for the news. For more information, call 800-909-9287. 69 degrees right now in Boston, maybe a shower this afternoon or evening. Still to come on Here and Now, a conversation with jazz guitarist Pat Metheny. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
This song, Don't Know Why, may be familiar, but the guitarist is unmistakable. 15-time Grammy Award winner Pat Metheny has just released his first solo collection, One Quiet Night. And earlier this year, students at Boston's Berklee College of Music had the opportunity to spend a not-so-quiet week with the guitarist and composer. They attended recitals, lectures, clinics, and a master class, and they had the chance to ask anything.
I actually like Italian food and Japanese food. Those are my two favorites.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
It's very unusual. This is part of a grant from the Herb Alpert Foundation. And actually, for the next 2 years, Pat Metheny will be spending 1 week at Berklee.
Rick Peckham is assistant chair of the guitar department at Berklee.
It's as good as it gets to have Pat here. He's been walking around the college. He's been staying on campus here in the dorm, and the motto of the school, Esse quam videre, to be rather than to seem to be. Well, it's totally personified in Pat Metheny.
And that's the next thing we're going to do, is that I want to hear you guys each play a little bit of this, two choruses each, unaccompanied, and we're just going to go around the room. And here's the goal. I want you to pretend like a spaceship from an alien planet just landed on Earth, and they've never heard a 12-bar blues. And you need, in your lines, to illuminate to them what a 12-bar blues is through your own playing. No chords, just single notes. One, two, three.
The cream of Berklee's current crop of aspiring jazz guitarists had been invited to attend this master class. I wanted to ask Pat, who's self-taught, a professional at 14, what he thought he could teach students. A disclaimer here, we're old friends. I can ask the really tough questions. I want to get back to your style, which has been described, your playing style, as there's words like spastic.
Yeah, that's a good one.
You have this light touch and this light lyrical sound, but you're gripping the neck and there's this muscular action. And what would you want your students to, you know, there are people who imitate that. What would you want people to do?
When I see a video of myself playing, it is truly bizarre what's going on there. And it's kind of amazing that anything comes out at all. And that's why in these masterclass type situations, when somebody starts asking me about how I hold my pick and how do I do this, that, or the other thing, I really say, stay away from it. Do it some other way, because this way works for me, but it's not recommended. The physical thing of playing for me is, in fact, not tense at all. It's very loose.
Haven't I heard you say, play from your stomach? And by that, do you mean not from your head?
I mostly mean not from your hands. When I say play from your stomach, I mean that you should internalize the pulse of the music so that you're not locked into having to physically delineate the beat with your hands or by patting your foot or something like that, so that you know where the time is and then you can just kind of be loose with it rather than having to cling on to the beat for dear life. You don't want to do that in a physical way. You want to do that in a more internal kind of a way.
Okay. Everybody's kind of going for complicated things, and that's great, and I understand that because complicated things are cool. But if something's complicated all the time, then it doesn't sound complicated anymore. It just sounds vague. And what I hear in every one of you guys is vagueness.
The young guitarists in this class were obviously surprised at both the easygoing manner and the candor of this jazz legend.
I'm just going to do a little bit myself. You'll hear I'm going to keep it very simple. But within the world of simplicity, I'm going to communicate to our alien, one, two, one, two.
Players are, you know, weak in is rhythm. All the kids are so concerned about being so complicated. I just keep thinking, play simpler. Then I realize as I work with them that it's much harder to play simple than it is to play complicated.
I think the alien would know where one was, he would know what the chords were, and he would get a little bit of my thing in there too. And that is much simpler than anything almost any of you guys played. And I think all of you would benefit from having the ability to freely play with very basic material of the form, using more rhythmic stuff. Anybody got a metronome with them?
Yeah.
You do?
There you go.
So in the class today, we spent a good part of the class just playing one note, but making it feel really good, like just a quarter note.
Even better, right?
Are you testing it to make sure that...
No, I'm just kind of testing me. Can I hear you do that?
Yeah.
I saw everybody first looking like, well, that's easy. You know, I can do that. And then I watched every single one of them kind of go, wow, this is hard.
For me, it was amazing to just sit with them in the same room.
To me, it was really tense. I was like, I couldn't speak at all.
Especially when you're here at Berkeley and it's just very stressful and you feel like you're almost working in vain a lot of times. And you see someone who's like Pat on his level and he comes here and he'll articulate a lot of the stuff that you're thinking about.
Makes you want to go back to the practice room and practice for 12 hours every day just like he did.
Hey, thanks for answering my question.
Sure.
I was wondering if you could put a sign
on. I don't
have
a pen, though.
Even a student musician who, having to go from E7 to A minor, and I hear you play C sharps, that makes me think that either you're really, really advanced or you should maybe really think about the thing. And that same exchange would happen between me and Herbie Hancock. I would think, okay, well, Herbie, are you getting like really chromatic on me here? Or am I missing something? Like, what is it? I mean, through a certain musical gesture, there's a question mark raised. And at that point, it's not really about teacher and student. It's more about music.
Thank you.
Two outstanding Berklee students who grew up playing together in Houston found themselves tapped to perform in a trio setting with Pat at the Berklee Performance Center that night, drummer Kendrick Scott and bassist Mark Kelly.
Playing with Pat over the last couple of rehearsals we've had has been an amazing experience.
What did you learn?
Honestly, the biggest thing I learned was about even eighths.
I have to ask you, what's an even eighth?
Even eighth music, like as opposed to swung music, even eighth, like for instance, Latin music.
Can you tap it out or sound it out?
Sure. The swung eighth, da 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 da, straight eighth, da 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 da. That's the best way I can really describe it. But becoming more creative with that, that was definitely something that I needed to face. And he put that front and center in front of me and said, deal with it. I've definitely been dealing with it over this week so that I won't make a fool of myself tonight.
No problem. You know, Mark is an amazingly talented guy. I mean, he really impressed me. Both he and Kendrick are going to have amazing careers. I'm really happy to get the chance to play with them.
Mark.
True. I don't know what to say. I'm definitely looking forward to tonight, though.
Yeah, me too.
Pat Metheny. His new CD is called One Quiet Night, and for more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. But we'll leave you with Pat and his student trio performing Ornette Coleman's Turnaround at the Berklee Performance Center in Boston.
Nobody quite sounds like that. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Special thanks to George Higgs, who co-produced the piece on Pat, and Sean Carberry, who helped out today as well.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com. Web at mathworks.com.